I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folker.
So welcome to Talking Biotech. It's the weekly podcast where we discuss innovations and breakthroughs in genetic engineering, and whether they're in medicine, animals, or plants, it's new technology that really is making an impact in many ways, and maybe could do more if we had a better understanding of what this technology did from a society side. Scientists feel pretty good with this technology, yet there's still suspicion in the public for lots of reasons we've discussed before. But one way we can break through that is by having better communication about what this technology is and what it isn't. What are the strengths? What are its limitations? And I just got back from the ASPB conference out in Austin, Texas, which is fun. And many people came up to me and said, you know, how do I get started? I would love to talk about this technology. I would love to be a voice of science. But there's a huge learning curve. There's hostility. I'm not sure how to start. So I thought it would be really great to have a guest on board who's already done that. And today we welcome to the Talking Biotech podcast Professor Paul Vincelli. He's from University of Kentucky. He's an extension professor and provost distinguished service professor, which is quite an honor. He's in the plant pathology department up at University of Kentucky. Welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Well, it's a pleasure, Kevin. Thank you for inviting me. And I do want to say at the outset that I really appreciate what you have done for science outreach, and especially through all the very difficult times you've had in the last year. So it's really a pleasure to be speaking to you today.
Well, likewise. I've always followed you on Twitter, and I've appreciated your blogs, your thoughts just in general in science, but also just the way that you really do help what all of us are trying to do in terms of sharing the science and sharing what this technology is and isn't. So thank you, too.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Well, let's start with what do you do on a normal daily basis before we get too much into the discussion of genetic engineering and its communication strategies? What do you do in, with plant pathology, both in research or extension?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been here for 26 years. Very much enjoy this department, and for all that time, as an extension specialist, I've had extension responsibilities for diseases of certain commodities. They've changed through the years somewhat, depending on the particular needs of the group and the people we had at the time. Actually, presently, and so I would do applied research and outreach on diseases and their management for any particular set of crops that I might be responsible for. Now, in the last couple of years, with the full and complete assent of the administration here, I have actually moved more into providing outreach on genetic engineering of crops, and I still do extension plant pathology, but I'd say more than half of my time is more on the outreach on genetic engineering because of the great need and the fact that my commodities are kind of humming along. There's no major fires to put out, and so it gives me an opportunity to talk about genetic engineering to the public.
That's cool. What are the major commodities in your area?
In my particular area, currently I am responsible for forage crops, turf grass, and forest trees. In the latter group of commodities, the forest trees are something I'm still on a steep learning curve on. I used to be responsible for corn, and until we hired another extension specialist who is really the country's best grain specialist. So I was responsible for corn pathology for many years as well.
Well, let's just real quickly, could you tell us what it means to be an extension specialist or an extension professor?
Sure. Well, we basically serve as the resource of some particular area of specialty in the full range of things that go on in the College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment. So every county agent they're actually pretty darn good plant doctors because of all the kinds of problems that come into their office, and they've got to learn what those diseases are and what those insect pests are, and you know they do a great job of that. But you know, whenever they run into something they don't recognize, or especially if they're new to the job, then we are the people they lean on the most for diagnoses, for recommendations, for maybe talks at commodity meetings in the state or in the region. So we're really kind of the narrow focus specialists for in the case of plants, for the plants that we, and any plant really in the state of Kentucky, we're responsible for.
And it's really interesting when you say that your subject matter is really shifting towards more discussion about genetic engineering. Because I know that in the state of Florida, I get invited to extension meetings constantly. People really reaching out because our extension agents are really being asked front and center, what is this technology? What does it do? What does it not do? What's safe? And it's awesome that Kentucky has the vision to kind of put the mantle on somebody to run with this. And how did that start?
Well, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I was on sabbatical in 2014, so just a couple of years ago, in Nicaragua, and the project that I had proposed to the Fulbright Commission, which was my source of funding, basically fell apart when I got there, and through no fault of mine, or no blame to throw around. But you know, I could have gone home, and I said, "Well, no, I don't want to do that. Maybe there's something else of value I can do." And I ended up doing some other very important kinds of learning. And one of those was genetic engineering. I just started reading papers that I normally don't have time to read. And I read for several months. I that was when I first was exposed to you. I recorded or watched that recording of your biotechnology day in Florida, University of Florida, several years ago. And, you know, and that was when I first became familiar with you and your work. And I said, you know, there's a lot here that people don't know. And wouldn't it be interesting to do outreach on this? So I contacted the extension administration in the college, and I said, you know, I've learned a lot about this subject. I'd kind of like to provide some outreach. What do you think? Are you okay with that? And the administration responded, yes, it's urgent. And so you know, like Florida, our college recognizes that there are many questions that people have. Some are strongly held opinions, but most Americans simply want to know more. And I think there's some opportunities to provide the genuine full range of the scientific findings that we know, those that we don't. And it's actually been very, very well received in Kentucky. The agents really have appreciated having somebody they can lean on for the full, everything. You know, I try to learn everything, not just, one particular area, but, the whole discussion with Ron Herring there a couple of weeks ago, the Indian suicides among farmers, that, everything that touches on this topic, I want to read about and learn about from credible sources.
Yeah, that's actually kind of the fun part of this, is that it's not a technology that's it's a technology that I grew up with, that, going back into the late 70s, early 80s as a kid and teenager, I was really interested in reading about all of this new area of genetic engineering. And even today, I find it really easy to digest all of the new literature because it has such deep context. Whereas everything else, I'm trying to hang, the newest information on what has already been a mountain of research I'm not familiar with. I share your interest there. How would you advise others who are interested in getting into this topic? What's the best first steps?
Yeah, there's some good ones. One, now, are they, typically do you find people who want to get in are sort of the scientific community working on in universities, or is this a sort of a bigger, even a bigger group?
Let's talk about university communities, because a lot of the listenership, we have a lot of grad students and postdocs and professors who listen, and I think a lot of them are hesitant to get into it because maybe it's not their area of their exact focus. But also because of the pushback, and so you're looking at a content and a presentation hurdle, and so what are some of the barriers that can help them overcome that?
Yeah. Well, I'd say that graduate students and postdocs and so on, and educators in this post-secondary realm have a pretty good idea of where to go for credible scientific information. So you've got that sort of leg up, you know, places like the National Academy of Sciences, peer-reviewed literature, things like that. You know, you already know where you can go for the most credible scientific information. The second piece of this is the one that I must tell you, it really, you have to hit me over the head so I can get this, but the social sciences have been very helpful to me in understanding how to better talk about controversial topics. And, you know, I've done outreach on climate change here in the state of Kentucky, and now I'm doing outreach on genetic engineering. And what is our tendency as scientists? What do we do if we throw lots of data?
Yeah, right? I know where you're going with this.
You know
one.
Where I'm going with this. Right. And the more data you throw, the less people are paying attention to in the general public. The data are what we want as scientists, and that's what our seminar is about. And you all know that if you're graduate students. But that the way to reach out to the public is not through lots of data. More data simply increase resistance. It's more it was a phrase you said on a program a few weeks ago, because I listened to all your programs, Kevin.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, everyone. I even when I was lecturing in China, I was listening to your program. So you said an important phrase that I should write down on my hand because I forget it so often. Shared values. If you're talking about genetic engineering, you probably have shared values with people in that audience. I mean, what do we care about? We care about, you know, an adequate supply of food for everybody, safe food, nutritious food, food produced in an environmentally sensitive way. And whatever the method that we get there with, we're sharing values with that audience. And it, bringing in that concept and showing that we're talking about the same things, that's one of the things that I've learned from social scientists, and there's more. Actually, my fiance is a social scientist, so I'm kind of lucky to got that kind of access. Really,
no, that's true. I mean, it's really funny because if you find that if you can earn people's trust and you demonstrate to them that you do share a similar platform, same concerns for your family, maybe for, you know, the planet, for, you know, all the things that we as gushy university scientists really got in the business for. And when people understand where we're coming from, they don't care about data, they don't care about graphs, they don't care about citations and authors. What they want to know is, well, is it safe? And that's it. You know, there you go past all of the need for information, because it's not correcting a deficit. It's establishing our authority and our trust as authorities who have studied this stuff, so that the good information can just flow directly.
Yeah.
We don't have to convince them with numbers.
Yeah.
And that's good, because, like you say, that's a language we speak. It's actually, I wrote an article that'll be on the ASPB blog probably Monday that follows that same idea. It's just that it's a different language than scientists are taught to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. All of our training is in how to speak to other scientists, and that's important. And so, you know, we're going to continue that. And if you're talking about a controversial subject, it's such a minefield because data are, we're both saying the same thing. Data aren't what sway the boat. Now, there are a number of things that I've learned from social scientists, but I would like to mention another, and that is because this has been useful for me. This is not useful necessarily with larger audiences, but on an individual basis, there's a model that my sweetheart calls the elicit, provide, elicit model. And so that's three components: elicit, provide, elicit. So elicit. What did you mean by that, or explain more? I'd like to really understand where are you coming from. So you elicit their what their concerns are, what their anything. You let them speak, elicit their thoughts, and do a little active listening. So what you're saying is this. Yeah, okay, got it, thanks. So then the provide is the second step. So would you be interested in more, some additional information? And so you provide, some additional information. And then you elicit their response. Elicit, provide, elicit. So now the second elicit is, what do you think of that? And I have found, there is no magic in this topic. There's no way to, for everybody to suddenly join hands and agree. But I have found that sometimes people that initially seemed rather resistant to, whose eyebrows went up when I said I provide outreach on genetic engineering, they would say, hey, okay, I see where you're coming from. Interesting, So there's still this aspect that bothers me, but there's that, and I can see that. So, social scientists really have a lot to offer us.
I can tell you maybe a funny short story on that was I went to a meeting in Yuma, Arizona a few years ago. That was a university, I don't remember what the meeting was, University Industry Consortium, and there were university and industry people there. And they had a section on science communication. And it was Robin Stryker from University of Arizona, Vance Crowe from Monsanto, Charlie Arnott from Center for Food Integrity, and me. And each one of us gave a talk. And it was really interesting because Robin Stryker came from a very parochial sociology background. Charlie came from surveys. Vance came from corporate side with all of the focus groups that they do. And I came at it from 15 years of boots on the ground talking to people. And it was so funny because we all came to the same outcome. And it all came back to like that common concerns, shared values message. Really weird. It's like we almost meant it to happen.
Yeah. Well, and with enough years and paying attention, maybe one can learn those lessons. I need those reminders. But it's true. There's some good guidelines out there from these kinds of experiences.
So you were talking about so not only do you stick your face in the fan of genetic engineering outreach, but you also stick the scissors into the electrical outlet of climate change.
That was where I had my first introduction to worldview. I had this idea that because I was an extension specialist and because extension is very well respected and trusted in Kentucky, which is true, I would be able to influence thinking on climate change because I did exactly the same thing as I do with genetic engineering. I read lots and lots of papers and I read lots and lots of information from, credible sources. And I went to the American Geophysical Union and met climate scientists and had beer or coffee with them. There's more to it than just the data. And boy, that was a surprising lesson. It was kind of getting swatted in the face. So really the climate change, this is no surprise to you, Kevin, but the climate change instance is very similar. Vaccines, climate change, evolution, and genetic engineering. There are social, psychological forces that are more powerful than just the data in terms of people's opinions on it. So we have to be able to negotiate those kinds of challenges.
And so what were some of the challenges that you see, like as an extension specialist? Do you find a lot of pushback in what is, technically a red state, which tends to adopt a more cynical view, or I should say skeptical view of climate claims? How do you find that extension experience?
Yeah, it was funny. I, I, there was, I got actually invited to more speaking opportunities out of state than in. So I don't know if that's because sometimes the prophet from, you know, a foreign land is the one to be heard, or maybe it was just because they could bring in this outside speaker and then I would disappear and, you know, they could blame me, you know, if when I was gone. But I didn't really get very many invitations to speak on the subject in Kentucky. I did get some. And I was glad for that, but I had several in some, you know, very skeptical settings, you know, grain growers associations in the region outside of Kentucky. So I don't know if I ever made a difference, to be honest. I was you know, I spent a couple years on it, and gave it everything. Never had really, fortunately, the bad experiences you've had in genetic engineering, but gave it my heart. You know, maybe I pushed the envelope a little bit here at the university in that way. But I think climate change, or sorry, genetic engineering, I'm finding to be a more timely subject, because really a lot of people are interested in and want to know more. Whereas with climate change, I think many people just don't want to hear it. They've got their minds made up. In whatever direction, and whereas in genetic engineering there are many that you know, even on sitting next to somebody on a plane, sometimes they just say, oh, you work on that, tell me more, you know.
Well, I guess I always am curious about the best way to communicate climate. I'm scheduled to give a talk on climate change in agriculture in December in Ottawa. But one of the things that I always like to communicate to farmers, and we're seeing it more and more in a place like Florida, is that the low chill peaches that require some chilling before they'll flower don't flower very well because they're not getting enough chilling. Our blueberries, not getting enough chilling. It just is, you know, strawberries, it's too hot all winter. And so we used to have this nice mild winter climate that now is borderlining on summer. And I think that the farmers who traditionally support candidates, which may have the skeptical, climate skeptic viewpoints, I think they're going to be a very strong voice, because they see in their hands and on their land, they see the evidence of the change. And maybe the way to communicate this in a soft way from a scientific standpoint is, we're not saying that you need to abandon your car and that you need to, you know, create new policy for whatever. But you have to acknowledge that it's real before we can start to come up with solutions.
Yeah, yeah. You know, climate change is very interesting because farmers are living climate change more intimately than anybody else. And so it's always been interesting that many farming communities, the representatives of the farming communities are so resistant to the basics of the science of climate change, because they live with it. But again, it's because worldview issues, you know, social psychological forces, the team that I identify with is, you know, those are more important, you know, than I think a lot of us natural scientists realize. One of the things that I've pulled out of the my pocket with when I've talked to growers about climate change has been, you know, actually genetic engineering, even before I was doing outreach on it, you know, and that is, you know, I mean, most grain farmers accept the science associated with genetic engineering. You know, they understand they're safe to consume. They understand the benefits that they see. And so they're very happy to accept the science. And so, you know, how would it be any different with human-caused climate change? They're living the predictions of the theory of global warming. And, you know, how can we reject the scientific community in one case and accepted it in the other, and knowing that there are people that do the reverse. They fully accept climate change is happening, it's human caused, and reject basically the scientific consensus around the safety of consuming genetically engineered crops. So maybe that will reach growers when they realize they're not, you know, they're accepting science in one case and not in the other.
Yeah, it's kind of the what I always refer to as the inverse Linus. You know, it's Mark Linus certainly was aware of climate and still is a very strong proponent of understanding climate changes. And did not have the strongest grasp upon what was happening with genetic engineering, and really had a kind of was very honest to himself in that he said, "We're going to look at all the data," and he'll be a guest on the podcast in a few weeks too. But we're talking today with Extension Professor Paul Vincelli. Your name was on my calendar, and my assistant said, "A nice Italian boy."
Yeah.
Paul Vincelli. But we're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be back on the other side and talk about some of your more international exploits and ways that you've been able to discuss this subject in other places. We'll be right back in just a few minutes. Hello, Talking Biotech aficionados. Thanks for listening. We continue this enterprise with the hope of spreading the infection of science. It's a curious pathogen that, when you contract it, makes you immune to nonsense and poor quality information. Like cupping. Well, now we need you to step up and be a shill for Big Podcast. Go to the place where you download podcasts and write a review for Talking Biotech. It can be positive. It can be negative. I don't care. Just share your thoughts, because that's the only way that I can get better at doing this. Suggest guests. Suggest guest hosts. Suggest a topic that you just want to understand better. Remember, this podcast is fueled by the kind interest of a wonderful audience, and your feedback helps keep us relevant and happy. Now, we've elected to not entertain sponsors or solicit donations, so your good vibrations fuel my groove. And remember, tell a friend, write a review. And now, back to the Talking Biotech Podcast. And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast with Dr. Paul Vincelli. He's an extension professor and the Provost Distinguished Service Professor at University of Kentucky in the Plant Pathology Department. And he has probably is the leading extension figure in the country with respect to getting out and talking to farmers, consumers about genetic engineering and climate change, doing a really nice job at taking the facts from the university out into the public. But your public doesn't just end in Lexington. You've been really busy all over the world. And so tell us about some of your experiences in other countries, and how is it a little different than what happens here?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I've been blessed to have all the opportunities to travel as part of my job. And my principal travel activities have been in Latin America and in China. So you mentioned the UK Confucius Institute. And UK, for your listeners in this context, is the University of Kentucky. We have a great Confucius Institute, and they arrange for summer teaching opportunities where we go, and lecturers like me go and spend 3.5 to 4 weeks at a university doing, you know, quite a few talks, but primary among those being a course, an undergraduate course, and I teach a undergraduate course in genetic engineering, risks and benefits. I always try to make sure that in those kinds of contexts we give at least as much time to the perceived or verified risks versus the benefits, or in addition to benefits, I should say. And that's been one of my recent activities is to go there into China. 2015, I was in Shanghai University. In 2016, this year, I was in Jilin University, and I plan to go back next year. So, and one of the things that I can say with confidence, and you may know this, Kevin, from your own experience, in this general field, is that the Chinese people are probably about like the Western Europeans in terms of their skepticism or hesitancy around genetically engineering food. They do grow genetically engineered cotton and papaya as well, but no other crops. Although they're seemingly quickly moving towards that in China. The government of China and the scientific community, by and large, are moving rather quickly towards that state where they are using genetically engineered crops. And so my interest in genetic engineering as a lecturer actually corresponds very well to their interests. And I go and I talk about that, and I always say what I know based on being a scientist, and the students learn to that it's okay to question me. You know, it's really okay. And I expect it, I reward it, they come to learn something about the science and hopefully have a better basis from which to go forward in their country.
Well, there's two really interesting aspects of genetic engineering, the genetic engineering story, in when I think about China, and I love teaching there too. I have a good time over there, but one of the interesting things is that Greenpeace has a very strong presence in China and does a tremendous amount of misinformation dealing, as they do here, and they do in Uganda and any place that's trying to adopt genetically engineered crops. And the difference is that their story is specifically trained to the young Chinese men and women, that they'll say you're going to be infertile. They don't say you're going to get cancer and autism and Parkinson's. They say you're going to be infertile because of all the questions about family and family size. They know that that's a hot button. The other really interesting thing about China is that if I go there and talk to colleagues who work in crop biology, they say that there are literally tens of thousands of genetically engineered crop lines just waiting in the wings to be released.
Oh, interesting. So. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, the thing about fertility, nobody's ever raised that question. So now you've given me a good lead, Kevin, to sort of tease that out of them, because they must have heard claims. And those become great learning opportunities. If they'll give that voice, then the next challenge is, okay, whoever comes with, a source of information on that topic, that I can read or that you can translate, we'll get some extra points, and everybody can get extra points. In other words, let them go and research it, and let's look at the claims and where is the basis, where is the science for it, to support it. And I did something like that this past time, and we actually went through one of the National Academy of Sciences reports, and they could actually see that there really is a basis for claims of safety and that it is supported by research. So I can envision doing the same thing with the fertility claims and let them dig for themselves, and we'll spend a couple class periods and so they'll learn the process of digging for what's behind the claims. Is there good science behind the claims? And at the same time, they'll be more comfortable refuting some of the claims that are being made.
And what about in other places, like in you've given lectures in Uruguay and other places? How do people respond in South America to the topic of genetic engineering?
Yeah, Uruguay. I think what do they call the Southern Cone? The Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay. There's probably enough of a solid large scale production farming systems that there's a mix of opinions, kind of like there would be here, and largely farmers, at least the large grain farmers, understand that there are benefits to the technology and so on. So those countries would be, you could certainly find someone that would be very opposition, in great opposition, but by and large, it would be like the United States. My experience in Central America was rougher on this topic. The students themselves really were interested, so that was promising and hopeful. But there are quite a few individuals in Central America that seem to be basing their claims on questionable information. And can be very influential. And there's an element in my experience in Latin America that I'd like to share. That is, I have come to understand that in especially the smaller countries in Latin America, Central America, for example, there have been so many bad experiences with domination by external influences. Our own country, for example, and multinational corporations, of course, that many times people in Latin America and in some of these smaller countries especially, they associate genetic engineering with domination. And so I wish I had really understood that at the time, because it would have been easier to then seek some shared values. Because I'm not, when I say genetic engineering, I'm thinking helping people have, you know, adequate food and nutritious food, the things, you know, less pesticides, you know, in the environment. Oh, these are all good things. We all care about these things. But when we, you know, when I say GMOs or genetic engineering, what they hear is domination. And, oh, you're trying to cause us to be dominated. And I'm, you know, I didn't know that that was sort of that underlying mindset. And so it's, yeah, you know, that's just one of those live and learn things, and I blog about it, you know, let other people know.
Yeah, it's actually kind of odd, because in so many ways, using more technology, and as we've seen with any other technology, it gives the opportunity to be free. And, you know, to be to immune or less likely to be under domination, because you know, countries, you know, especially in Africa now, that are doing this on their own, because they don't want to wait for the West to have to sort it out. You know, which I give them so much credit.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a good place to kind of segue into those kinds of ideas, that in so many areas of the world, there are opportunities, especially in the area of plant pathology, to be able to control a pest or a pathogen and using genetic engineering. And it's one of the places that we really haven't seen the technology penetrate in commercial crops, outside of papaya, obviously, where, you know, viral diseases, some squash. But as a plant pathologist and somebody, you know, who really knows that area well, what are the most promising mechanisms that you think could make a tremendous difference for farmers and for consumers?
Well, yeah, thanks, Kevin. I'm very interested in this topic, and I do think we are definitely underutilized in genetic engineering. Not that it's, as you know, the only answer, but you know, to problems. But it is a powerful set of technologies, and there's no question we're underutilizing it. And I'll make a shameless plug for my paper on this topic. But for the readers that are interested, in the journal Sustainability, I wrote a review paper on this very topic. So, you know, look for that if you're interested in seeing all the things that I can't cover. But let me give you an example to respond to your question. Here's an example. There are genes which you might even understand better than I do as a plant scientist. You've got a much longer history than I do in understanding the molecular basis of what plants do. But all right, there are genes that are what we loosely call susceptibility genes. And so the plant is producing, with a susceptibility gene, it's producing some product that is some molecule that is beneficial for the plant and beneficial for the invading parasite. And so if sometimes we can disarm that susceptibility gene, just, you know, do a gene knockout of in various ways, including CRISPR technologies. And by knocking that susceptibility gene out, we may not harm the plant in any way, but if the pathogen needs that molecule in order to be able to invade and parasitize, then now we've deprived it of that molecule. So those plants become more resistant to infection. And what's important about that, there's a couple of things that are important about disarming host susceptibility genes. One is we're not introducing any foreign DNA. You know, introducing a gene from a bacterium into a plant doesn't worry me, but it does, you know, have that unpleasantness factor for some people. Okay, well, in this case, we're not doing that. We're just disarming a gene, maybe knocking out one or two nucleotides or causing a substitution in one or two nucleotides or letters in the DNA string. So it's very easy. There's no introduction, conceptually easy. There's no introduction of foreign DNA, and it's probably going to be durable, because you're not putting on a poison and forcing the parasite to adapt to the poison. You are depriving it. When you knock out a susceptibility gene, you are depriving the parasite of something that it needs. And so now it must create some new function to replace the lost host molecule that was encoded by that susceptibility gene. So that would be just one example. Disarming host susceptibility genes, we have a wealth of opportunities through genetic engineering, more every month. I sure would rather do that than spray pesticides. That's my bias on this.
I love those ideas, because being able to disarm the signaling pathways or disrupt the signaling pathways that inform that allow a pathogen to become a problem, it's easy to do that. And you look at all the strategies that we've used. There's been many that have been kind of like dominant gain of function ones, like BS2, where you can make the tomato immune, which that was like episode, I don't even know, 12 or something in the series. But so many good opportunities. What are some other good targets aside from, say, like these kinds of receptors and other types of molecules that we could maybe mutate so that pathogens can't identify with the host? What are some other examples?
Well, a couple. One is using gene silencing to silence pathogen genes. You know, that so any basically, really, I think many pathogen genes can be silenced through incorporating a piece of that gene as DNA into the host. There's another angle on genetic engineering which I'd like to really say something about, and that is deployment, because I think this is really an important reason why we're not going to abandon conventional breeding, as you know, and it's still critically important. And genetic engineering helps us in a way that is more difficult with conventional breeding, mm-hmm. and that is through deployment. So we want to deploy genetics by whatever means we obtain those genes that confer resistance. We want to deploy those in a way that confers some degree of durability, right? To contribute to sustainability, we want the genetics we use to last a long time. And there is no such thing as a gene that will overcome a parasite forever. I don't believe there is. They adapt. But we want to gain the most duration from the genetics that we use as possible. And there are a couple ways that genetic engineering gives us an advantage over conventional breeding, and one is gene stacking. So, we know that having multiple genes for resistance that work in different ways against the parasite, that's going to be more durable than a single gene. We know this. This is well established in the literature. So, how do we stack multiple genes that say target? It could be the citrus greening parasite. If we had three or four genes that conferred resistance, then we could stack those together, and that would be expected to be much more durable than a single gene. That kind of stacking is more—it's just easier to do with genetic engineering than conventional breeding. The same is true with rotation of genes. If we confer some sort of or create some sort of rotation in annual crops, where we use gene A for 3 years in the breeding program and then switch to gene B and for 3 years. Again, that kind of movement of a different gene into an elite background, genetic background, is going to be, as far as I understand, easier with genetic engineering than conventional breeding. So, and taking advantage of the diverse mechanisms that I've described in this review paper, again, that's going to be that depends on our use of genetic engineering. So there we have scientists. I don't say we because I can't take credit for all the great work that molecular biologists have done. But molecular biologists have blown open the doors in recent years. They've blown open the doors on the kinds of strategies that are available to us to engineer resistant plants. And more strategies are likely to be published. And in order for us to take advantage of those so that we can improve food security, so that we can reduce pesticide use, I think it's just like a cell phone. We could live without cell phones, but why would we want to? You know, and we could live without genetic engineering, but why would we want to? It just offers us a way to do things that are important to meet the genuine needs of our brothers and sisters, and to address environmental challenges of food production.
No, very well stated. I share your thoughts 100%. You know, the need for plant breeders and plant genetic improvement, it's such a diverse field in so many ways we can do it. And really, the genetic engineering is just the cherry on the sundae. You're looking at one last little tweak that really must happen inside a very strong and high yielding and all the good horticultural traits that you would want in your crop. So it's really an important message. I guess the other thing I was thinking about was recently with respect to your work was your recent blog about biocontrols and this mm-hmm. concept of safe and natural. And do you mm-hmm. want to expand on that a little bit here? Oh, I should mention, I will post a link to your paper, your plant pathology paper.
Oh,
I'll do that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So tell me a little bit about the biocontrol blog, because it was an interesting take.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. It was actually this all started. Well, let me back up. The plant pathologists and people like yourself working in agricultural sciences come to understand eventually that the concept of natural doesn't mean safe. And we commonly confront this kind of assumption that I've honestly must say I sometimes have incorrectly, but falsely, but that's what, you know, I sometimes have. We commonly confront that with pesticides or synthetic chemicals. Synthetic chemicals are bad. Natural chemicals are good. Well, of course, you know, there's aflatoxin, which is perfectly natural and perfectly
sure.
hazardous, right?
Yeah, dog turds, lead, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Many, many examples. Everybody's got examples. So I had been exposed to that assumption that natural is safe is, you know, many years ago. But, it dawned on me that the same really should be challenged in the biological area. So all right. So like there are biological controls that are being researched. Some are on the market for plant disease or for other uses. And I got into the literature because I got a phone call. It was really an upsetting phone call. It was from a woman that was suffering an infection, an opportunist infection by Erwinia herbicola, the current name of what used to be called Erwinia herbicola, a bacterium that actually has biocontrol properties and for plant disease. And she told me she had this opportunistic infection, and she was very scared and wanted to know how it got there and so on. And so I explained to her that it's this is basically a widespread bacterium in nature, and there's no telling where she got exposed to it. But this idea that it was an opportunistic human pathogen, I was not exposed to. And so I of course spent time digging into the scientific literature on that. And not only did I find that it was indeed an opportunistic human parasite, but there are other examples of human opportunistic parasites that are, at least by the species name, are also have been researched for their plant disease biocontrol properties. And so I think I listed five in that blog piece, and maybe the easiest thing to do is put up a link to that too.
Yeah.
And another one that I would add is Burkholderia sepatia, which is really should be on that list too. So there's six, you know, recognizing the species concept of bacteria can be in flux. There are six species, at least some strains of which, bacterial species, some strains of which can provide some degree of biocontrol of plant disease, and other strains of which, maybe some of the same strains sometimes, can be found in humans. And so I wrote that article, again, to challenge people to understand that the same assumption, that natural equals safe, is really an assumption that doesn't hold up even in the biocontrol realm. And in fact, at the American Phytopathology Society meetings there a couple of weeks ago, in a couple sessions, I just nonchalantly brought this point up again because I had this great opportunity. And I could see that it got people's attention, like, what? opportunistic infection. So you know, we all need to be exposed to that point that, you know, that if whether it's natural or produced by an industry, that doesn't determine safety. What determines safety, or at least what points to whether it's safe or not, is the scientific evaluation, and not just an assumption that natural is safe.
Yeah, my favorite that I always get is, well, we've been doing it for 5,000 years. And, you know, that one just doesn't wear well with me, because the same people that are saying we need to have over-the-top evidence for some new technology or, you know, some new drug or whatever, are the first ones to say, well, obviously the Chinese have done it for 5,000 years. It must be wonderful. You know, it's a very strange dichotomy.
Yeah, well, and people have, you know, not to make light of people's fears and concerns, we do respect them, and I also point out, and people have been dying, you know, young for, you know, for as long. I mean, really, life expectancies have only increased in this you know, the last 100-150 years, and in parallel to adoption of technology. So and you know, every plant, you know, when it comes to genetics, every plant is a unique creation, genetic creation and epigenetic creation. So you know, everything you know can be considered to be worthy of evaluation. Not it's you know I know I'm speaking to the choir here, but genetic engineering, as you know, it doesn't create a unique risk. It, you know, by and large, it's not it doesn't create a unique risk. So yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. No. There's nobody in any choirs that listen to this, by the way.
Okay.
So you're not preaching to the choir. No, they're out doing other things. Now, science podcasts not always real big. Well, I guess it's a good place to wrap it up. So thank you very much to Dr. Paul Vincelli, that extension professor, provost, distinguished service professor at University of Kentucky in the plant pathology department. You know, you're welcome back anytime. And if you ever want to co-host this thing or host it on your own, let me know. You'd be wonderful.
Okay.
You know, and
thank you.
It would be great for you to use this platform to build your extension empire. Tell us where we can find you on social media.
Oh yeah, actually, I'm most active on Twitter. So I think it's at @PVINCELL, and so that's, in fact, those I do post things to Google and to Link and to Facebook, but Twitter is my sort of preferred social media. So yeah, I'd be glad to interact with people there.
That's a good place to do it. And I retweet everything I can of yours when I see it. So thank you very much. But thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Kevin. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. I appreciate it.
And that's it for Talking Biotech today. Remember to really think about these technologies and the way in which they could benefit mankind. They could be good for the planet and for people, of course, with reservations and careful testing. And as we go forward, just try to spread the word about what these technologies are and aren't, starting out by communicating what is important to you, what's important to your family, what are the stories around you and in your life that really made you choose to do what you do. And then as a you're not coming at people as a teacher and as a scientist, especially a know-it-all professor. You're coming at people as a trusted friend who they can relate to. And that's the way that we're going to solve this problem. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.
You've traveled through the valley of the shadow of death. And I'm sorry, I was so hard to witness that. But.